Next time on this episode of Watchers of Tomorrow, we talk about science fiction!
Hello, everyone. My name is Gepwin, and I am joined here by my friend Dr. Izzix.
Hi.
And this is the first episode of our new show/podcast, where we are going to be looking at some sci-fi TV.
Also known as Watchers of Tomorrow.
Yeah, that's why I was going to let you say that. So the basic idea is both of us are kind of sci-fi obsessed.
A little bit.
And I, you know, watch a lot of sci-fi television, and I thought it would be kind of fun to just do sort of a sci-fi retrospective thing. Like, we'll go through, we'll watch, like, one episode of something every week or every couple weeks, depending on our schedules and such, and then we'll go through and do kind of a deep dive into each episode of a series for your enjoyment and entertainment and critique, hopefully.
And also for our enjoyment and entertainment. And now there's some things I've, like, did I miss that episode? Episode 24 of this series? Oh, gosh. What have I been missing in my life?
I do think there's some stuff that I just haven't seen. Like, I remember I got this idea because Dr. Izzix here was talking about going through Deep Space Nine again, which I haven't seen in a while, but you mentioned Babylon 5, which I've in fact never seen except for like the first two episodes. So there's just some holes in sci-fi education that I'm hoping to be able to fill here.
Yes, same here, actually. You know, we're going to be sort of poking first at the original series of Star Trek here, which I'm 80% sure I've seen all of, but I'm not 100% sure I have. So
yeah, it's kind of hard to remember. I figured if we were starting this thing, we should start at what is kind of arguably the granddaddy of science fiction television.
Yeah.
Because it did exist before original Star Trek. There were things like Captain Video and the Video Rangers. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe some of Twilight Zone and some of the anthology-style series predated
Outer
Star
Limits.
Trek. Yes, Outer Limits. That was the one I was trying to remember.
Yes.
So I believe that those also predated Star Trek. But Star Trek is sort of the episodic adventure adult sci-fi that people tend to think of, especially once you move kind of out of the 80s and more into the late 90s golden age of sci-fi television.
Yes. You know, it's sort of the idealized version of sci-fi TV when people think about sci-fi TV. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to be talking, you know, spaceships in outer space going around and doing things. Well, you're talking about Star Trek, right?
Yeah. And it's just, I find it kind of interesting because we've both been doing a little research and backstory, because first episode of this, I kind of figured we shouldn't talk about the first episode of the show yet because there's so much kind of backstory and other things about, you know, sci-fi series that you need to get out of the way. It'd be very clunky to try to talk about that and do an episode at the same time. So this is kind of the prologue history of making of, you know, science fiction up to and kind of the historical context for where the show existed. And Star Trek is such an interesting one to me because it's such a monumental series at this point. It's basically been running almost nonstop on television for about 50 years or so.
The only thing that can compete with is Doctor Who. And yeah.
Yes, and that also had the big break and reboot.
Yes, and you know, and that's sort of a different sort of genre of science fiction as well, to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I would kind of, I don't know enough about early Doctor Who. I'm sure we'll get into some of it at another point. But I would kind of compare, like, Star Trek is kind of the American quintessential sci-fi, and Doctor Who is sort of the UK quintessential sci-fi.
Correct. Unless you want to go into, like, Red Dwarf.
Yeah,
that's something else entirely.
That's true. Though that's more of a that's much more of a satire.
Yes. Speaking of Star Trek, I remember in one of the sort of specials about Red Dwarf. They actually had Patrick Stewart on, and he was basically, you know, in the UK doing some, you know, some work involving Star Trek, like going to conventions or I don't know. But he mentioned just turning on the TV and watching for a bit. And he's like, wait, there's this science fiction show here. I need to, like, call my producers and see if there's, like, someone just trying to copy us. And then he, like, has the phone in his hand, is dialing, and then he realizes, oh, this isn't anything like Star Trek. It's kind of making fun of the genre, but, yeah, this is cool. All right.
So, you kind of mentioned it. What is kind of your, like, history with, like, science fiction and Star Trek, I guess the original series specifically, but more kind of the science fiction sphere in general?
Well, I guess those are fairly linked from the early get-go. Sort of thinking back to my earliest formative years, I'm pretty sure Star Trek was sort of the first thing that I was sort of aware of in the genre in total. I'm not sure if it was TNG or original series, because they were both playing on TV at the same time during that era. You know, just, you know, original series and syndication, TNG when first run.
Yeah.
I guess I am that kind of old. I remember greatly enjoying it. What was it, like middle school, high school era, the local Fox station had on the Next Generation starting at like 10 in the evening, which technically I was supposed to be in bed, but I had my own TV at the time, so I'll just turn that on and claim I'm going to sleep, and I'm going to sleep watching Star Trek, while I actually just watch Star Trek and do my homework.
So it's not a bad way to go to sleep.
No, and it's usually a pretty good way to help me focus as well, because even if it's an episode I'd seen before, just sort of having the background noise was kind of therapeutic. And that's how I graduated high school. Also enjoyed a lot of Star Trek. After that, actually kind of the same time, I was also taking in a lot of Doctor Who, because it was on the PBS station at the time. They were running it as a first as full adventures and then doing like two episodes a night, going through the full series. And so that's how I got my exposure to like all the classic Who stuff. After that, the DS9 was running and Voyager was showing up, and also Babylon 5, and I was sort of taking these in whenever I could. When I got to college era, I stopped watching so much TV, which, you know, given that Star Trek was kind of vanishing, that was kind of okay. you know, around the Enterprise era, I was not really watching TV at all, so... which I guess maybe contributed to Enterprise not doing so well.
Yes, it's all your fault.
I know, right? I'm sorry, guys, but it's my fault that there was another break. Oh, gosh. So much responsibility. From there, yeah, after that, things were a little bit more sporadic, I guess, for a good long while until the Doctor Who reboot. Then I guess the rise of the Marvel movies and all that sort of stuff for big action movies that are all kind of linked once again was becoming big, and they had Star Trek reboot movies of the Kelvin timeline, I believe it's called.
Yes.
And now they got Discovery, which I don't got the streaming service for CBS, so I've been sort of taking in some of the details of that sort of vicariously through others, but I hear it's pretty good, so.
Yeah, same. I guess we might have to get to that one eventually.
Maybe when I can get easy access to it.
And you've kind of currently morphed into a science fiction creator yourself, haven't you?
Yes, yes. I've been... doing lots of writing these last couple years, and I'm actually doing the edits on my science fiction novel. I can give you a quick rundown of that if you like.
If you would like, we can see how our time works out.
I'll keep it super short. The premise is it's following the life and times of the new administrator of a colony on Europa, and she has this issue that there might be some crazy stuff going down on Earth, so they might be isolated and unable to get resupplied. So they need to figure out, okay, what can we do to not die? Thankfully, there's other colonies around. They just happen to be controlled by other governments.
So I think some of the like political stuff and similar will probably be kind of your wheelhouse as we keep going through the series here.
A little bit, yes.
All right, well, I kind of had a similar history, except I got introduced to Star Trek through Next Generation very specifically, because my mother was a massive Trekkie.
Oh, nice.
From the original series. So she got super excited when Next Generation started coming out, and it was just kind of this thing that my and my mother would do every week is just watch the new Star Trek. And we went up, like, all the way through. Like, we watched every single episode of everything up through Enterprise.
Even Sub Rosa?
Yeah. Yeah. But the odd thing with that is I don't think I've ever actually seen every episode of the original series. I've watched some in syndication, and I've seen, like, bits here and there. I know enough to hit the major beats of episodes and be familiar with the characters, but I've never actually seen every episode. I've seen every movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went back and rewatched the entire series, so there's definitely going to be some of these that is my first experience with them, even if I've heard of them. And let's see, other than that, I kind of got into a lot of science fiction television, and I also kind of went back and got into some of the old pulp stuff, so read a decent amount of Asimov and Heinlein were kind of my go-tos when I was a kid. But I also kind of have, since I have dyslexia, the reading has never been my strong point, so that's why I got much more strongly into kind of the movies and television side of the genre. A
little easier to digest.
Yes, because it as like I can read the pulps because they're written to be consumed quickly, but it still takes me about a week to get through one. So that's kind of the like Star Trek history on my side.
And I didn't even really talk about the red word on my consumption. My experience there is kind of sporadic, but I guess I found myself really enjoying some more obscure authors in total. Not like totally unknown, just like not necessarily the ones people that would recognize. I have read plenty of Asimov, though, so.
Yeah, and he was kind of involved with some of the Star Trek writing. Yeah, so there were several fairly well-known science fiction authors that got kind of involved in the show. It was a bit after what people are referring to as the golden age of sci-fi with the pulps, which I just had up and now I can't find my notes. But the pulp golden age was kind of in the 40s and 50s. And yes, then
your sort of Flash Gordon-esque sort of stuff.
Yes. And then coming out of that into the 60s is when you started getting more of the TV. And then you hit 1966, which is when Star Trek aired originally. But it was actually in development for like 3 years before that.
Yeah, it was like 63 or 64. Gene was all like, hey, I got this idea for Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yes, his Wagon Train to the Stars, which even he in interviews admits was a complete fallacy and just there to sell to the studio people.
Well, it worked, so. Yeah.
Yes. So I guess that's a good segue into kind of the show history.
Maybe a little science fiction history first.
Yeah, because that comes before.
You see, I'm gonna go way back to the dawn of time, and you got this story about this person who constructs a being and brings it to life using esoteric means, and then it goes about the world and it falls in love and its love is rejected and he gets angry. You know this story?
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's been recycled a bit.
Yeah, this is the story of the Golem, of course. Though the more science fiction version is called Frankenstein. That was sort of the kickoff of the science fiction.
I knew you were doing a switch there, but I still wasn't going to guess Golem. So good.
Yeah, the Golem of Prague is the most well-known version of it, but there were several different versions of that particular story well back into antiquity. Mary Shelley was all like, all right, we got this stuff in like people are doing science and they're like causing bodies to twitch. So maybe they'll figure out some way to actually make living things. What would that mean? What would that result in? And then, then she wrote a story about it. So, and from there, people started like, well, maybe we can sort of use these ideas of what could be to sort of speculate of what might be. And, you know, we could sort of explore the human condition along the way. Because science fiction, in the end of the day, is still about us to a degree.
Yeah, I think that really gets to the thing. And, like, I don't know if you've seen it, but I've been kind of binging Extra Credits History of Science Fiction.
Oh, yes.
Which, if anybody hasn't seen it, go watch that entire series.
It's amazing.
It is. And they kind
of
use... They use Frankenstein as a jumping off point, and they kind of develop a definition of sci-fi, which I don't remember their exact one, but it does include the science element, but it's arguably less important than using the fantastical parts of the science to explore humanity and the philosophy. And especially with a jumping off point like Frankenstein, where it's very grounded in the romantic literary tradition.
And we're not talking Edgar Rinder here either, by the way.
Okay, I don't even get that one.
He's a rock musician from like the 70s. He did a song called Frankenstein. Anyway.
Okay.
So the trappings of science fiction is it's a genre trapping. It's a shell to put around the investigation of an idea. And this is actually kind of very relevant to Star Trek in particular, because one of the things, you know, Gene Roddenberry sought to explore were questions of the day, you know, sex, religion, you know, current events, you know, the whole Cold War stuff, you know, and sort of using Star Trek as an allegory for these sort of issues, to use it as a means to, it's like, we're not technically talking about this, but we're talking about the ideas behind it, the situations that, you know, people will find themselves again and again, and maybe trying to figure out, okay, what's the better way to be about all this? What can we do, and what failings do we need to be sort of aware of and watch out for as we progress through these important issues?
Yeah, it's very much the kind of the central thesis of the show, in fact.
Yeah.
And the story, which I agree with slightly, we can get into that as we go through some of the episodes, but the basic idea and story that the actors and creators tend to share is that during this time period in the mid-60s, the television censor board was very active, and it was like, you cannot, like, do this set of things. So, like, the good old sitcom trope of a married couple sleeping in two single beds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, things like that. You can't allude to sex. You can't talk about racism. You can't talk about anything controversial. And kind of the Star Trek idea was, well, we can, as long as it's non-humans.
Yes. So we got some aliens with black on one side of their face and white on the other, and they got their buddies that are basically the reverse coloration. And that's obviously something completely different, guys. Honest.
Yes, and it's interesting. We'll get into more as we go through the series, but that's one of the things that I find very fascinating about original series Star Trek in particular, is it takes this idea to such an obvious place.
Yeah.
The allegory and the metaphor being used here are so thin.
Then again, censorship boards aren't necessarily known for their literary prowess. They're looking to measure how much exposure of cleavage is going on here.
That is true. So my theory is either the censorship boards were not paying very much attention at all, which, if you look at some other things that were getting around the censor boards around that same time period, could very much be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, they didn't care that much. It was like, don't talk about race specifically. We don't care if you allude to it in a very, very obvious way. Just, like, we have our list of things you're not allowed to say. Don't hit those. It's fine.
The people that we're really worried about are the people that aren't really paying attention and don't care about your show until some loudmouth somewhere in the country is all like, hey, this thing was talking about this. I'm outraged because reasons.
Yes.
And then you're in trouble. But if they don't got that little spark, the people that are, you know, that are going to be that sort of loudmouth just won't get it. So it's fine.
Yes. So people probably don't want to hear us go through the entire history of science fiction, but we kind of jumped from Frankenstein to Star Trek.
Yes.
And
well, you know, you had a good segue with the whole, you know, talking about the philosophy stuff there.
Yes.
So.
Well, it's good to bring it back in. But we did have a decent amount between there, because mm-hmm. Frankenstein was, what, 500 years ago?
No, it was early 1800s.
Okay, so only 200.
Just a couple centuries, and it's fine. You know, she was hanging out with, like, Lord Byron and things like that, who was also an interesting character.
Yes. But
that's maybe for another time.
So, but I think the most direct kind of literary tradition that you can pull from for Star Trek's version of science fiction would be pulp novels.
Yes.
Which were very much kind of it's a kind of episodic writing that we don't really have in an analogous form of today. And that is some of the kind of quick pacing and action beats that you would get. So, like, I was recently reading an Asimov book that I hadn't in quite a while, The End of Eternity.
Oh, I've not read that one, but I am familiar. That's the one with the big building where they have, like, an elevator, right?
No, this one is a time travel board. Basically, it's time travel as a bureaucracy.
Well, maybe we are thinking the same thing. So okay. I heard a description where there was like an elevator that took you to different time periods.
Okay, I could see how that description could fit.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't want to get into a bunch of spoiler things, but the thing that I was noticing is since it was originally written, like most things from that era were, in this sort of episodic pulp form, every chapter or two, a new villain or a new conflict or a new problem is introduced. So you have like two chapters of dealing with a problem of solving some sort of time change that they have to make. And then suddenly it jumps into a problem of one of his coworkers maybe conspiring against him. And then suddenly it jumps into a problem of part of the time elevator is blocked off. And these things just happen so fast to keep the action up and keep the cliffhangers going for you to buy the next issue of Amazing Stories or what have you.
But that's all together here in a book form, and so it's maybe a little unusual if you're used to longer form narratives.
Yes. But that kind of spawned itself into the Buck Rogers style, which was very, very action oriented. And I feel like some of the pulp stuff probably started moving a little bit away from the cerebral and into the action focus just to keep the attention of the audience.
And gotta sell those books.
And that then moves us into, like, Buck Rogers, early television, you're like, the sci-fi that you think of that has a rocket ship with strings on it.
Dun, da, 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 da.
Yes, which is very much the opposite of cerebral science fiction. This is your kind of sci-fi trappings on an action adventure story.
Correct. You know, I've heard of, as far as like the Star Trek movies go, that the sort of the quote good ones tend to fall very much into one side of this divide or the other. That they're either very good action, say Star Trek First Contact or Star Trek Beyond, or they're very like good cerebral stuff, like you know, your sort of your motion picture. Mm. Even though people are like, oh, that one's a slow one, but I actually still rather like it.
That is a pretty good one. Undiscovered Country is probably your best cerebral politicky Star Trek.
Yes, and so there's sort of a you know, these are some legitimate subgenres of science fiction that are very different. They have very sort of different tropes going on, but they all sort of still fit under the same overall umbrella.
Yes,
but they're the pulpy sort of action adventure stuff. As far as the writing stuff started changing in the 40s, I believe, right?
Yes, that would have started. The pulps would have started in the 40s, mm-hmm. which for people unfamiliar, pulps mean trade paperbacks.
Yes.
So it was the first time that you could produce paper very, very cheaply and put it into one of the perfect bound pocket-sized paperback books that you could buy for a few dollars instead of a hardcover book that you had to make a major investment in and store in your house.
And so you could mass produce these and sell them for cheap, and people could buy them for cheap, and suddenly all these stories were basically everywhere. They were accessible to everybody. And so you kind of had to be a marketing them in a, you know, it's like, well, what sells to everybody? We don't want to be doing a run of, 5,000 books if there's not going to be selling them.
Yeah, and it's kind of that kind of idea, too, that brings into many of the tropes that we recognize in science fiction today, mm-hmm. especially some of the slightly more misogynistic and racist bent.
Yeah, you know, you know, the strong, you know, jawed guy, you know, saving the damsel in distress with the very big tracts of land, and you know, the situation where there's this bug-eyed monster that's all like, I'm here to steal your women, and I'm maybe this other that you're naturally just afraid of, you know, like those other people over there, hint, 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 and yeah.
Yes. And not to get into too much the history of racism in science fiction, because that would be an entirely different show that would take forever. But this is kind of the ideas that you have when Gene Roddenberry starts developing his initial idea for a sci-fi television show. Because you could kind of look at the beginning of Star Trek the original series as let's take the action adventure sci-fi drama and start putting the philosophy and thinking back into it.
Yes. Sort of melding the two together to create something new. And thus, we have space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. It's a 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Insert music here.
And see, it's interesting that you got to there, which you obviously would. But the kind of intro to the show is indicative of the kind of development process that Star Trek went through. Because so much of what you were talking about just in the introductory segment was introduced into the show either directly as a result of trying to go against some of the conventions of the trade paperbacks that weren't as, you know, that weren't being well received in Roddenberry's eyes, the things that were like very Flash Gordon, space adventure, go out and shoot everything.
Yeah, stuff for kids and people that are easily abused, but not the proper intellectual, cultured viewer or reader.
So you have like the mission to explore and the mission to seek out new civilizations. And that was very interesting to me because I was reading an article on the early genesis of the Star Trek
Genesis Project
intro. Yes.
Sorry.
the Star Trek introductory scene there, obviously read by William Shatner, who plays Captain Kirk. Apparently, about 10 minutes before they had to edit it into the first episode, as legend goes.
Can I just read this? Okay.
Yes. Like, basically, stop recording the episode you're recording and go to the soundstage now. So the basic idea here is they had a lot of kind of problems trying to fit this idea into an episodic series.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the things that are mentioned in there, the mission to seek out new life and new civilizations, were because for one of the first times they were thinking about the kind of hard science problems that you hit in sci-fi television. So, you know, if space is so vast, why are we meeting a new alien civilization every week? Well, it's because this ship is on a very specific mission to seek those out.
Yes, we're trying to actually, yeah, we want to find them. We want to say hello. We want to introduce them to our United Federation of Planets, this idyllic union of many worlds, and see if we can get along and maybe hang out sometime.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's the thing that I find kind of interesting when you look back at something that originated so many tropes like this. Because if, like, them actually going through these problems created a lot of the things that we take for granted now. So the idea of the M-class planet is we want them to be able to go down to a planet every week and be able to breathe. Artificial gravity was created so they didn't have to put the actors on strings every episode.
Which could have been hilarious, but very expensive.
Yes. And so much of this was cost-saving. Because
like the transporter.
Yes. The original series was very strapped for cash the entire time it was running.
So we'll just put a filter on here and have some like water in the little mirror thing, and then suddenly you're teleported somewhere. Neat.
Yes, you have things like that with the transporter, says they didn't want to have to spend special effects money on landing a ship on a planet every week. And the one planet set with different colored skies.
Yes.
And just all of these things. There was this book that I read in preparation for this that I just looked up the name for because I couldn't remember, that I would recommend, called Inside Star Trek, The Real Story, written by Herb Solo and Robert Joustman, who, along with Gene Roddenberry, were probably the two most influential people working on the original series. So anyone who's interested in this, in the history that we're talking about, I would very much recommend that, because it's directly written from two sources who were there immediately after Roddenberry's death. They decided to write this just to get this stuff down before all the actual stories were lost to time.
Yes. You know, preserving history before it's lost to the ages.
Yes, exactly. So that was kind of the thing, like all this cost-saving stuff, just thinking about all these things, it created this entirely new thing. And I think it's important for us to try to remember that as we're going through, because looking back at it now, we take something like a transporter for granted, because to us, this thing has existed for 50 years.
Yes. Well, not existed, existed, but, you know, in fiction.
Yes. It's just been, like, if you go to basically any person on the planet and you say transporter or teleporter, they'll basically know what you mean. But at this point, the idea of a sci-fi television show like this wasn't even conceivable. In fact, there was a story in this book when Herb Solo was pitching this idea to Lucy from the Desilu Studios, Lucille Ball. She thought he meant a series about USO performers because it was called Star Trek. So you're taking stars on a journey off to the islands to entertain the troops.
I get it.
So the basic idea and premise of the show was so foreign to people at the time that the executives didn't even understand the idea of making a sci-fi TV show.
So you keep saying it's science fiction, but we don't get it. Why is, you know, going out to, you know, entertain the troops anything involving science fiction? Is this a future war? What's going on? I don't get it. Please explain it to me.
So then I guess we should get a little bit into just the very early history of the show, because it was kind of in what we would think of as development hell for about 3 years.
Because there was like two pilots... And then the first episode that aired wasn't one of the pilots, and it was a little weird.
Yeah, well, that was actually pretty common at the time. They didn't really shoot episodic television in order. They recorded about 6 episodes to start, including the pilot, and then just reordered them for syndication, for broadcast. So they just looked at all of them and were like, which one introduces the characters best, which one has enough audience retention hook. So, like, originally, Gene Roddenberry had this original pitch. They had to take it to a lot of different studios before they finally landed at Desilu, which at the time was kind of a failing studio and was really only making the Lucy show.
Which was still pretty good.
Yes, but this was like after the time period of Lucille Ball's and Desi Arnaz's divorce.
So it's a little awkward.
Yes.
Still.
So the I Love Lucy show, of course, couldn't continue because they both starred on that. And then she moved on to making the Lucy show, which was still fairly good if you can find it. It's not as well known. But that was the only thing they were producing. And then they brought them this idea for a new sci-fi show. And after a bit of convincing, they decided to make it, and they got the contract for a pilot, which had an entirely different cast. So you didn't have Captain Kirk or any of the main series. The only character that carried over was Spock.
That strange alien at the pointed ears.
Yes, who Roddenberry was very attached to, though originally was meant to be red and devilish looking.
I was unaware of that one.
Yes, they changed his color because on a black and white TV, red paint just shows up as jet black.
It'll be a little confusing.
Yes.
To put it lightly.
Yes. And So the original pilot, which I don't want to get into too many details, because you have the original pilot, which was later turned into, like, piecemealed up to turn into an actual episode of the series later on.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to. It's about episode 11.
A bit further in.
Yes. Then this completely unheard of thing happens, where the studio says, we don't like the pilot, but...
it sucks, but we like it.
Yes. Well, it's basically, we think it's too cerebral for our audience. But we purposely gave you the most difficult script, and you pulled it off. So basically, the story after this was they came in, and they're like, well, we didn't think you could pull this off, so out of the script briefs you gave us, we picked the one that we thought was impossible, and you did it.
So, bravo. Can give you another chance. Yeah.
Yes, and doing two pilots for a series was basically unheard of at this point. So, Roddenberry brought over most of the cast from his previous cop show called The Lieutenant, which is where he worked with most of the people in the show before, and they did the second pilot.
That was where No Man Has Gone Before, right?
Yes. That was later aired as No Man Has Gone Before, which I believe is episode 3 in the original broadcast run.
The shirt colors are probably a little different on that one.
Yeah, the shirt colors are a little different. They didn't have the same doctor. They hadn't brought on DeForest Kelly yet.
People watching the show at home when the first airing happens, like, what happened to Bones?
Yes, I honestly have not watched... I haven't watched this far in a while, so I can't remember how they handle that in the episode.
Yeah, neither can I. So, I've already gotten my first viewing of The Man Trap in since forever.
Yes,
the other day. So,
It's
like McCoy and Spock and Kirk are all there, and Sulu's even hanging out. He's like hanging out with some plants.
Oh yeah, the plants.
We'll get to that next episode.
Yes. So after the pilot, it gets picked up for its run, and then you go into the basic broadcast, which we will be getting to next episode with, as you mentioned, Man Trap, because we kind of had some debate on this and where to start, since arguably it has three different first episodes. But I was so kind of thinking that it would be best to kind of go through it in the way it was originally presented to the public.
Which might not necessarily be production order, but it is sort of how it was experienced the first time. So since, it's been a while since, either of us have really sort of taken in the series, it might be kind of a unique way to sort of do it, sort of re-experience as it was at the time.
Yes.
Be honest, if we, progress through various science fiction far enough to get to Crusades, that might be the way to go there, too, which will help us draw out some comparisons to how Star Trek was sort of done out of order as well.
Yes.
If you're not familiar with the show, Crusades, it was the spinoff from Babylon 5. It ran for like most of a season, and both the episodes were the broadcast order was horribly out of order compared to their production order and where they were supposed to be intended to be, because they wanted more sex appeal and things like that in the early episodes to get people hooked. And then, the more we've got some plot to take care of, stuff will happen later,
Yes. when that was what, 90s, early 2000s,
later 90s. Sorry.
Okay. So later 90s, that was, studios would do that, but shows were kind of meant to be shown in a certain order. And at this time period, they're not.
Yeah, it's very episodic. Everything's sort of self-contained.
Yes.
You might occasionally have some callbacks, but you don't really need that. That'd be sort of the same sort of references that they'd be doing to things you've never seen in the show before. Like, oh yes, that's so-and-so from Starbase whatever, and that guy's never showed up before, so that's fine.
Yes. So... I meant to get to this earlier. We got a little carried away, as we're going to do from time to time.
Oh, we're excited.
So <It's> fine. This show came out mid-60s.
Yes.
Which was far enough ago at this point that I feel we may all need a refresher on what the 60s was. Especially someone from the millennial generation who has only heard of this in song and story.
Yes. Thousands of years ago in the 1960s. The United States was in a time of difficulties.
That's putting it mildly.
The Cold War was raging. Vietnam was like this thing that was going on forever, and people were being drafted and sent off to war. That was not really a war, but a policing action, and there was some, yeah, Agent Orange. And, anywhere, where was I? Oh, yeah, they got the civil rights struggles going on, and you know, and they got protests in the streets. A lot of angstiness, but also this sort of idealism, and yeah, not a terrible economy overall, but at least for most of the decade, I think, right? I forget.
I think most of the decade.
But you got sort of this... It was very much a transition point in the country from the old way to our more modern sensibilities of what we understand the country to be. And there's a lot of... let's just say there was a lot of social unrest.
Yes. So, middle of the Vietnam War... actually, several years before the manned moon landing, which is interesting for how much space stuff is in this show.
Yes.
Middle of the space race, the Russians had just landed their first probe on the moon.
So we're past Sputnik. We're on to, I forget that probe's name now.
Yes.
I know this.
I have the Wikipedia page open, but one of my windows is covering the name.
Oh, no.
Soviets Luna 2.
There Luna 2, okay.
So Luna 2 had landed on the moon in, since I have the Wikipedia up, in 1959. So about 3 years before Star Trek was pitched and 7 years before it actually aired. But the moon landing is still 3 years out. You have civil rights. So race is a large issue. Desegregation is kind of in its initial throes.
You know, Brown versus Board of Education was, you know, a number of years back, but, you know, the whole Civil Rights Act has just been passed a couple of years before, and actually maybe like a year before. Was that 65, I think?
Yes, I think so. So then out of this comes this show, which is very optimistic. Humanity, in fact, has not destroyed itself in a Cold War-style nuclear standoff.
Hey, we survived.
Yes. We not only survived, but we have expanded into this multi-planet, space-faring, exploratory, post-scarcity culture.
You know, this utopian ideal of what could be if we just keep our stuff together and keep progressing towards a brighter future.
Yes, you have the bright future, this incredibly optimistic show, with a multiracial cast.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for a time of desegregation, a little bit of like several years after World War II, but still sort of recovering from that. And yes. In the middle of the Cold War, you have a Japanese American on the bridge, and you have an African American on the bridge, an African American woman, which is even more unheard of. To get both a woman and an African-American on the main cast of the show.
You can sort of get away with it as far as the oh my gosh, this is impossible. It's like, this is the future. You never know what's going to happen in the future. Plus, we're dealing with idealism here. And you like idealism, right?
Yes. I mean, if you listen to old interviews, everyone talks about how groundbreaking this is. Studio executives from the era will... swear up and down that they had a significant policy of multiracial hiring all through this period.
Ha! Ha!
Yes, so...
And, I got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn there.
So very, very specifically, Roddenberry envisions this show originally. Like, this was his pitch going in to have... multiracial cast kind of crossing the current boundaries we have up to and including a Russian character who is not in the first season.
Yes.
But they do eventually have a Russian character on the show in the middle of the Cold War.
Yep. It's like, this can't be allowed. Right.
Yeah.
This is the future. Maybe the Cold War is over. Maybe we're friends with them at this point. Well, what do you mean there's no Soviet Union? Okay, that's okay, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's think about this. We'll delay it a season.
And you do get several episodes, some very bad, that deal very, very directly with the idea of the Cold War and Vietnam and war, political standoffs, including nuclear annihilation. But I do feel like we can't idealize the show and Roddenberry too much, because while he was fairly progressive as far as racial inequality went, he does have his very specific brand of sexism.
Yes, he was a little creepy in some ways.
Yes, I feel like if this had been going on today, Roddenberry would be in the middle of one of the larger Me Too scandals.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people really want to idealize him as kind of this science fiction genius, which I don't really want to argue with.
There's a lot of big names in science fiction that had great ideas and pushed the envelope and did this, that, the other thing, and were highly innovative, who are also kind of scumbags.
Yes. And I do feel like it's very important to mention that, yeah. Especially coming out of some of the other tropes. So, like, you know, Asimov, very sexist. Lovecraft, the huge, huge racist.
Oh, yes. I remember one of the awkward stories involving Lovecraft where he starts, like, railing against, like, you know, the you know, Jewish conspiracies, and then his wife comes to him, and she's actually Jewish, and she's like, honey, stop being an idiot. And he's like, oh, crap, you caught me again.
So while I agree, the show, very idealistic, especially for the time period, definitely made some very good progressive strides, but I think going through, especially on some specific episodes I have in mind, it's important to not forget that the people who made these things were not saints.
You know, everyone has flaws. Sometimes they're kind of obvious.
Yes. And it's also very important to point these out. Not to hate the show, but, I mean, even within the cultural context of the time period, there were some things that were, you know, they were not okay by those standards, and they definitely should be called out now.
Yes.
Just to say where we're all coming from.
You know, so I'm going through my watch through of Deep Space Nine. It is kind of curious they still keep mentioning Orion's slave girls, for instance.
Yes, and that was kind of an interesting one to me. Because, again, from the book I was reading earlier, they didn't call them Orion's slave girls at the time. But the green-skinned dancing alien woman is from the original pilot episode and was actually cited as one of the reasons the show didn't get picked up, because the networks were afraid that that level of kind of provocativeness and sexuality would be in the show.
Like, we're not too comfortable with this. Could you tone it down a little bit?
Yes, and you had a few things. So, like, I don't want to get into a huge number of specifics, but yeah, you did have him having affairs with cast members. Michelle Barrett. I'm always bad at names. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was his girlfriend during the original pilot and the first run of the show. And I don't want to specifically say this, but many of the things that I read, which are written by also somewhat sexist men, credit that with the reason she is on the show to begin with, and also say that, like, the networks were very against this to begin with. But like I said, this is all kind of secondhand stuff that I'm reading, and I really enjoy her as an actress, and I love what she does in this series, and especially her continuing runs on Star Trek.
Yes.
So I certainly don't want to say this is why she got the job, but this is sort of the perception that existed around the show and Roddenberry's interactions with women when this show was being made.
And it's sort of one of those things that's like, okay, it's maybe not the full truth of what's going on, but it does look really bad.
Yes.
So that's something to keep in mind as we progress.
Yes.
Through the future of tomorrow.
Though I feel like I may have left us on a very down note when we've kind of covered most of what we were going to cover for the prologue episode.
Well, I guess maybe one thing I kind of wanted to bring up is sort of looking back, you know, how we are today at even just like the basic look of original series of Star Trek, it seems almost like a dream. Like you're floating in this, you know, yes, it's the purpose is an ideal world, but it's almost like it's too ideal. It's like something that is an impossible dream. But you know, sometimes it's okay to have impossible dreams. That it's okay to it's like, okay, we acknowledge our current failings, but you know, maybe we can see something better, a better tomorrow, where we all live in a world of peace and harmony. And yeah, maybe the lighting's a little melodramatic, but that's fine, you know.
Yes, and I think like it's going to be really interesting going back to this, especially with, like you said, just how absurdly idealistic some of it was. Mm-hmm. Because it's not coming out of an idealistic time period.
No.
So like, if you do look...
Sort of reaction to that.
Yeah, and if you do look at kind of the analogous things we have today... Now, I'll admit, we both said we haven't seen Star Trek Discovery. But from what I've heard, it's a very dark show about war and, you know, moral gray areas. And probably very interesting topics to cover in sci-fi. But it's just interesting that like our period of non-idealism is not producing responses that are overblown idealistic television. So it'll be really interesting to kind of get back to that as we go through this series.
It's original series Star Trek is in some ways like an ancient legend telling of a promise of great things to come. That if we hold true to our principles and, you know, manage to figure out a way to all live together, maybe we too can join that United Federation of Planets.
Very well. Very well said. I think that's a good note to leave off.
You have been listening to Watchers of Tomorrow, a podcast on science fiction media. You may find Gepwin on youtube.com/Gepwin and on Twitter at Gepwin, spelled G-E-P-W-I-N. You may find me, Dr. Izix, on youtube.com/Dr. Izix, spelled D-R-I-Z-I-X-S, and Twitter at Izix, L-P. Music is Waveform by D-R-K-R-N and Morey's Principle by the same. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure to subscribe for more. And share the experience with your friends, family, enemies, and alien overlords. If you feel you are suffering from transporter syndrome, please be aware that the next time you step off the transporter, the you that is will no longer